You're hearing voices.
As a son of survivors, in a community of survivors, the Holocaust was always with me as a child. I didn't survive the concentration camps, come to this country alone with no money, not able to speak English, so you could climb monkey bars and fall and break your neck.
Shoah.
Tonight we commemorate Yom HaShoah,
a Holocaust memorial.
Shoah in Hebrew means whirlwind, and it signifies complete destruction.
From NPR, this is Hearing Voices.
So we had to go on the so-called death march.
For the next hour, we'll hear stories of the Shoah.
You had to keep up, because if you fell down, they shot you.
Ani, ani, mommy.
We attend services in Billings, Montana, and Cleveland, Ohio, and we speak to survivors.
At the beginning, they shot you right on the spot. But after a while, why waste the bullet? Let them freeze to death.
Shoah, the whirlwind of destruction, from hearingvoices.com. Shoah means whirlwind of destruction. It's the Hebrew word for the Holocaust and the name of this radio special. I'm Rabbi Samuel M. Kohan of Temple Emmanuel in Tucson, Arizona. For Jews everywhere, the Shoah is a powerful, haunting memory. Each year, we move farther from the horrific events. Yet each year, we are drawn back again, seeking to understand what cannot truly be comprehended. Sometimes it is the mere impossibility, the incomprehensible destruction of literally millions of great and good people and an entire civilization that strikes us afresh. As poet Paul Celan, a survivor himself, said, "There are songs to sing beyond humankind." This is Shoah from NPR and Hearing Voices, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and the National Endowment for the Arts. In the next hour, we'll hear stories from survivors and sounds from Shoah services. We'll hear 1945 recordings from a concentration camp and listen as people try to make sense of what happened. Our first documentary is by Jay Allison. He lent Dr. Alan Birkenwald of Haydenville, Massachusetts, a recorder to tape conversations with his parents. From 1998, this is Descended from the Holocaust.
This is a song, and it was adapted as a hymn.
After the war.
In the name of the song is Zug nicht kemel, als die Geist im letzten Weg. Which means, don't say never that you
go the last mile.
Going the last mile, because it's more to look up for the future. And I'm going to sing it the best way I can. Zug nicht kemel, als du gehst im letzten Weg, wenn Himmeln bläuene verstellen bläuete, weil kommen wird noch unser Haus gebänkte so.
Both my parents are survivors of the Holocaust. Polish Jews, they were barely teenagers when the war started. They survived the Ludge Ghetto, slave labor camps, and Auschwitz. As a son of survivors, in a community of survivors, the Holocaust was always with me as a child. I didn't survive the concentration camps, come to this country alone with no money, not able to speak English, so you could climb monkey bars and fall and break your neck. After the war, my parents had little use for God, but if there was one, they wanted to give him a zetz, a sharp, punishing slap. On the Jewish High Holy Days, when we Jews were supposed to fast, my parents would make a big breakfast for my sister and me and say, "Eat! We fasted enough for both of you already." The Holocaust was present in everything we did, but my parents would never speak directly of the war or the camps and would never tell me about the horrors they survived. When I would ask a question, they would put me off. "What's to tell? You shouldn't know. You would never understand it."
This is my son now, and this is Risha.
Hello.
Nice to meet you. I heard a lot about you.
It came as a surprise then when they announced one day that they and their survivor friends had rented a bus and were going to the Holocaust Museum in Washington. I realized that here was an opportunity to learn about my parents' past finally. Living history, I would bring a tape recorder and ask them what they went through for myself and my children. They agreed to this.
I'm going to be the reporter.
As we were loading and getting settled, my parents proudly introduced me to all their survivor friends.
But that's why I'm here. I'm here to remember. This is I'm recording this for my family, for
good.
My children.
Good. Very good. I'm proud. I wish my son comes here and do the same thing.
Well, not everyone takes the time off.
He's too busy.
Getting on the bus, everyone was busy catching up on each other's news. They were smiling, laughing, passing pictures of children and grandchildren back and forth.
This is my best friend.
My next door neighbor.
Oh, it's like that.
It's like any reunion. Any reunion when friends get together. The idea of all these friends getting together to go to a death camp and reminisce is confusing to me, but it doesn't bother them. Or if it does, they're not talking about it yet. Right now, everything is fine. We're happy. We're going on a picnic. Strangest picnic.
Both my parents came from large families. My mother was the youngest of seven. My father had four sisters. Yet, the only relatives I ever knew were my Aunt Helen and Uncle Leo. They were both on the bus.
Let me ask you this. Yeah. When my folks told me they were going here with all their friends on this bus, I couldn't understand it. It'd be like somebody wanting to go back and revisit a nightmare. So why? You were there. It's important for me to go, but why are you going?
It's important for us to see.
Why?
I think it's an obligation. Now, people sometimes ask you, why do you go to punish yourself or something? People do ask that. It's true. Maybe we want to punish ourselves. Maybe we feel, why me? How come the others didn't survive? And you ask that constantly. It never leaves us, no matter how happy our wedding, our party, or whatever, how happy we seem to feel or we seem to look. It's always with us.
Helen and Leo had two children, my cousins Steve and Amy.
Did you ever tell this to Steven and Amy?
Like me, they'd never heard their parents speak in detail of the past.
They never really asked, you know, and we never talked about it.
Why? My folks never spoke to me about it, and I'm not sure why.
I don't know why, but I never did. Maybe it's something in us that we're ashamed of it.
Ashamed?
Why?
Why?
Exactly. No reason for it. I didn't do anything, right? I don't know why. I really don't know why. But I never talked to them.
We arrived in Washington and spent the first day sightseeing. Our visit to the Holocaust Museum was arranged for tomorrow. We took in the Capitol, the Mint, and a few other tourist destinations. It was a long and tiring day. Back in our hotel after dinner, I sat with each of my parents separately and alone and asked them to tell me, for the first time, what happened to them during the war.
My life was a good life.
My mother, who was outgoing and spontaneous, a woman who loves to sing, needed a lot of encouragement. Her story came in bits and pieces and began in the Lodz ghetto in Poland.
The situation became that the cold winters, we didn't have wood, we didn't have coals, and we didn't have food. Whatever they gave us, a little bit, we couldn't even exist. So my father, there was no food. And whatever we got, he didn't want to eat. He saved it for me. And I was old enough to understand that I didn't want to take his piece of bread. And I didn't take it.
In my mother's story, there was no philosophy, no analysis, only a stream of remembered details. This was the first time I had heard her talk about my grandfather's death.
There were no tombstones. I mean, this was no such thing. They told me that they put his name with a little, just his name and a piece of wood. That's it. And I don't know where. I don't know where. I was never in a cemetery. Okay. Then times were very, very bad.
When the Lodz ghetto was liquidated, the remaining Jews were brought by cattle cars to Auschwitz. The selection process began.
They brought us to Auschwitz. And they told us to get off the train. And we came in. There were a lot of people there. And I came and I was holding on to my mother and my brother. So the men went separate And they wanted, and my mother, they told to go this way, one way, let's say to the left, and I should go to the right. And my brother right away, they took him away. So my brother went away. I see all the men go in one direction. And me with my mother, I was happy. I was going with my mother. All of a sudden, a soldier with a big, huge gun, and he said, my mother should go this way. And I said, no, I wanted to go with my mother. And I didn't let her go. So he pulled me away. And with the rifle, he gave me a push in my back. I should go this way. And I didn't want to go. But he gave me such a push that I fainted and I fell on the floor. So the women who went, who were supposed to go the same direction I went, they pulled me with them, and that's it. And I never saw my mother from my eyes. That was the day. I didn't know where my mother went, and I didn't know where I'm going, and where all the other women are going. All of a sudden, we come to near a barrack, and they take us in, and they tell us we should take off our clothes. Take off our clothes? I mean, we couldn't understand. What do you mean, take off our clothes? They said that we're going to get a shower. And we should go in a shower, and they're going to take off our hair. Shave our heads. All right, the hair wasn't important. So we went, and with just shaving off the heads, and we were naked, and we're supposed to go and take a shower. Nobody talked, but each and every one knew that we're not going to come out from those doors again, because we knew already that gas comes out where the shower head is. Yeah, instead of water, gas is going to come out. Nobody talked. Nobody screamed. Nobody cried. We just went. We took orders. Whatever they said, we did. Funny thing. We all knew we were going to die, and nobody ever, we just looked at each other, no tears, that's it. Luckily, we saw water, and the water came out. Then we started to cry. Everybody was crying, and it was a shower, and that's it.
My mother told me things no mother should ever have to tell her child. I had asked her, so she told me the horrors because she loved me. I don't remember how I felt as she talked of the camps. I only recall taking a deep breath when she was finally liberated. When my mother finished, it was my father's turn. We sat in a quiet alcove off the main lobby of that Holiday Inn.
So we were assigned to a certain building, Building 16, I think it was, and Auschwitz was no picnic.
Auschwitz was no picnic. All my life, whenever he spoke of the war, it was like that, until tonight.
They started to count, and all of a sudden there were too many people. So they started to look, so they pulled out my father. Because of too many people. So I went over to the guy, to that German, and I said that I want to be with my father together. I don't know what happened. Maybe he liked me or something. And he said, yeah, take the shit with you and go ahead. So I was glad.
Take
the shit with you. That means your father, you can take it with you, because they took him out. So I said, danke schön. Thank you very much. And I took, and we went back in the line. They took out somebody else.
As he talked, I realized that my father's story was really the story of his father. They were together almost to the very end of the war.
As long as I was with my father, I was able to help him. Because I was younger, so I did some harder work, so I was getting extra rations. So I was able to share him with my father, and everything was okay. Finally, one day, I come home after a day's work. They're telling me that my father was selected to be sent away from the camp. So I saw him, and he told me, that's what it is, that I should see to survive. He don't think so that he will. And after the war, I should go back home and see if anybody survived. Then I never saw him anymore. He was sent to a camp they called Neugamma. That was near Hamburg. And I spoke with people after the liberation that he had them not too bad, that he got sick, and he died. And we were struggling until we got liberated from the Americans.
When my father had finished, we were both exhausted. I walked him back to his room for the night. So now I'm outside the hotel room. I'm in the parking lot at night under a tree. I go back to the hotel room. My mom is there. She says, so you got the story? You heard the story? You know, I say things I never heard before. Things I never knew before. It's the first time in my life. I'm 41 years old. I learned the story of what happened to my father in the war. And I think towards the end, he was getting tired. He was talking for over an hour, so we started rushing through details. It's interesting. This is the first time in my life I ever saw my father cry. When he talked about the part where his father died, I had no idea they were that close through the war, which is also confusing because I'm close to my parents now, but I never felt I was close to my father when I grew up. He was always working. He was always working. And I was an American teenager, and I didn't want to hear about the war. And now for the first time I'm dealing with it. I'm trying to deal with it. I don't think I've ever felt as intimate with my father as I did this evening. This is Thursday, August 12th, the day after my parents' 47th anniversary, the day that we're finally going to get to go to the museum. Are you looking forward to this?
No. No. As a matter of fact, I'm kind of shaky.
As everyone boarded the bus that morning, the day clearly had a different tone than yesterday.
All right.
The smiles were a bit forced, the conversation a bit strained. No one spoke with eagerness for the next stop.
I don't know about you, but my folks today, they're acting more jumpy than they usually are.
Yeah, because it's... me too. I was very nervous. I couldn't sleep all night. Thinking, and you know, and when I closed my eyes, when I dozed off, I had such a terrible dreams. I dreamed that the Germans are chasing me, they want to catch me. You know, and when I woke up, I said, oh, thank God it was a dream.
My name is Stephanie, and I'd like to welcome you all to the United States Holocaust Memorial Museum. What you're going to see today...
My heart rate's up, I feel a bit nervous, tense. It's like all of a sudden I'm going to be exposed to my past, the memories of my parents, the history of who I am. It's like all of a sudden, finally revealed.
The library and the archives, the oral history.
As they went through the exhibit, my parents and their friends rarely, if ever, read the captions alongside the displays. They scrutinized the pictures, searching out every detail, identifying buildings, calling out names on shops.
4345.
That was your building?
Seeing Hitler, the architect of their nightmares, they referred to him in terms that someone else might use for the paperboy who forever kept throwing newspapers into the hedges. Ach, it's him. Look, it's him again. They had not come to the museum to remember and grieve, but on an inspection tour. They came to see if the job had been done right, if the curators had honestly fulfilled their contractual obligation with history, their past. They moved through that museum as if they owned it.
That's the wagon.
This is the wagon that took us in, closed the doors. And there was a little window.
They must have bring it from Germany.
Yeah.
That's an original. We were in there for about 3 or 4 days till we got to Auschwitz.
We rejoined the group waiting in a large brick-walled room off the main hall. On a long stone bench running the length of the room, the survivors were sitting shoulder to shoulder chatting. They talked about dresses and skirt combinations, about their children, about what they needed to do when they got home, and where they'll eat tonight. Their voices spilled and echoed out into the main hall. Other visitors walked by and stared, offended by what they saw as a lack of respect, not understanding. I understood. These people were part of the exhibit. They are the living museum. Sitting with their done-up hair and fancy eyeglass frames, gold jewelry and designer pocketbooks, not one was struck dumb. It was a display of perfect symbolism. Their power, their light, could not be extinguished. It continued to burn bright, even in the shadows cast by their memories in this museum.
Anything at all.
Here, loudly, their voices carrying through the hallways was proof that the Nazis had failed in their mission to erase the future of these people.
I'm not against it. We need this very badly.
Nice bus.
We left on the bus the next day, the 40 survivors and I, to resume our normal lives.
If you're willing to sing for me, I'll hold up the microphone. I'd love to get it on tape.
1, 2, 3, go!
In the museum's Hall of Remembrance, above the burning eternal flame, they have upon the wall this quote, "Only guard yourself and guard your soul carefully, lest you forget the things your eyes saw, and lest these things depart your heart all the days of your life, and you shall make them known to your children and to your children's children."
Ohne Wiege fallen ist ein Sprotz von unser Blut. Sprotzen wird noch unser Gewure, unser Mut.
That's it.
Hast die Dem, the Seite, kina fecha, le halamim. Utsirol mit zarachayim. Adonai hu nachalatam yanuchu v'shalom amishkevoteihem.
Descended from the Holocaust was produced by Jay Allison with Christina Egloff for their series Life Stories at jayallison.com. Narration and recordings are by Dr. Alan Birkenwald. Coming up, 1945 recordings from a concentration camp, 1994 Shoah services in Billings, Montana and Cleveland, Ohio, and the documentary Voices of the Shoah. That's in a minute when we return with this Holocaust Memorial Special from HearingVoices.com.
Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. From NPR, this is HearingVoices.com.
Welcome back to Hearing Voices in our Radio Holocaust Memorial. I'm Rabbi Samuel M. Kohan of Temple Emmanuel in Tucson, Arizona, and TwoJewishRadio.com. I first participated in Yom HaShoah services when I was a boy in Los Angeles, singing songs like Ani Ma Min and Zognit Kainmol and Babi Yar, words and melodies of remembrance and poignance. I was often the youngest one there, surrounded by survivors. I am no longer young, but somehow the memories are sharper, more defined, more meaningful even now. The following are the prayers and people of Congregation B'nai Jeshurun in Cleveland and Beth Aaron in Billings, Montana, where I was the rabbi in 1994. These are Yom HaShoah services, the day above all, on which we remember what was not lost, but destroyed.
Tonight we commemorate Yom HaShoah. Shoah in Hebrew means whirlwind, and it signifies complete destruction.
Ani ani ma'amin b'emuna she'le'emar b'viyat ha-Mashiach ma'amin ma'amin ani.
In that small town in German, southern Germany, Kitzingen is the name of it, not far from Würzburg. This is where, on the Crystal Night, I had to watch our synagogue burn to the ground. The Jewish people of that little town, we had to build a circle around the synagogue and had to watch the synagogue burn to the ground. And then all men of this little town were loaded on trucks to Dachau. Even so, my father was fighting in the German army during World War I, and he came home with some kind of a decoration. He had to end up in Auschwitz.
The entries for March 19, 1945 show that on this day, 203 people were sent to death. They were assigned serial numbers from A81173 to A81376. The names of the dead are carefully listed. The victims are all reported as having died of the same ailment, heart failure. They died at brief intervals. They died in alphabetical order.
Josh Friedman will start. When I give the signal, you'll all stand. This is to go sing. This is not for the March of the Generations. This is to go sing.
Yom HaShoah came about because people sensed the need to remember, and to remember the 6 million martyrs of the Holocaust and the 2 million children. And we also remember the 3 million others who were killed in the camps, along with the Jews, gypsies and homosexuals and any dissenters, political prisoners.
I lost many, many of my friends, Jewish and non-Jewish. And there is no way to make up for erasing my life.
And in ghetto, my 21-year-old brother died of starvation in my arms. And I and my mother buried him. Afterwards, we went to Auschwitz. We were shipped to Auschwitz. There we were standing in front of the crematoriums to be sent to the ovens. The flames and the smell of human flesh was unbearable. They didn't have time for me. I was standing in front of Dr. Mengele, though, and he had to decide over my life if I should live or die.
Before my eyes, as he tried to reach my young brother Aaron, who was selected to be shipped to Helmnodet camp. As storm clouds gathered, we said Kaddish. I placed flowers on the mass grave where my father is buried.
We must never be complacent. We must never stop telling the story of the Shoah to Jew or to Gentile alike. I'm pleased that tonight we come together in such numbers as a community to honor the memory of the 6 million, to the rescuers, and to fulfill our duty to them by educating mankind on the horrors of hate.
My father was beaten to death, and I had to watch him die. The only time ever in my life that I lost faith in God. And I said, if God allowed something like that to happen, then there is no God. And in the very same night, my father appeared to me in a dream. And he called me on my Hebrew name, Yitzhak. And he says, don't ever lose your faith in God. God is real. And you will see that you will survive.
The hatred that destroyed those millions of Jews sparked up a little bit in our town this year.
I had gotten a phone call in the morning saying Jew bitch died.
There had been a bomb threat during the high holidays. There had been some hate mail circulated. Some tombstones were pushed over in the Jewish cemetery back in September. In December, around the Hanukkah time, there were two incidents where members of this congregation had their homes attacked. One had a bottle thrown through a storm door, and then a brick was thrown through a window. Both of those windows were decorated with Hanukkah menorahs.
And I knew the ultimate risk wasn't a brick or a gunshot. It was my community turning their backs. But they didn't.
Christian congregations rushed to put up menorahs in their windows as a sign of solidarity. They were giving them out at the convenience stores.
We saw billboards with Happy Hanukkah signs. And suddenly, you didn't feel like you were by yourself anymore.
All over town, you saw menorahs, you know, homes with Christmas trees and Christmas lights and sleighs and menorahs in the window. And some of the people and the churches that put up menorahs also were vandalized. But nobody stopped. My own sense is that God gives us almost infinite capacity to do either good or evil and allows us the ability to choose. And often it results in wonderful things. And perhaps even more often it results in horrible things. But I still want to have that choice. Kaddish, our memorial prayer. Between each word, you recite the name on the site of a massacre or of a camp. Yit Gadol, Luz, Beit Kadash, Gurs, Shemei Rabbah, Warsaw.
Now I decided if anyone is going to ask me from now on what was going on, what happened, I will tell, I will talk, but not with hatred. I'm still hoping that mankind will realize one day that it's a better way, is to love thy neighbor, as they say.
We have a responsibility, and that is to speak up for those who can't, or for those who are not being heard.
We see the evil Nazi monster, and the neo-Nazi movement is echoing that evil. Sort of a pathetic reminder, but there is so much capacity for good in human beings, and it's up to us to activate that. It's up to us to live that.
Dachau, Damiran Be'olma, Auschwitz, Nimru, Amen. Yehesh Lama Rabba Shema Shemaya, V'chaim Amen, Yad O Yisrael, Nimru, Amen. O Yisrael, Shalom, Yomad.
O Yisrael, Yom HaShoah 1994 was produced by Barrett Golding with recordings by Rick Carr. You heard cantor Edward Berkowitz,
the Agnon School Choir, and myself, Rabbi Samuel Kohan. Also, Heinz Prager, Gitta Frankel, Shani Braun, and Tammy Schnitzer. You're listening to a Hearing Voices radio special for Yom HaShoah, Holocaust Memorial Day. Voices of the Shoah, Remembrances of the Holocaust is a 4-CD set on Rhino Records. The writer and producer is David Notowitz. His documentaries drawn from interviews with more than 180 survivors. For the rest of this half hour, let's listen to an excerpt from Voices from the Shoah. We'll hear the extremes of hardship and the touching demonstrations of humanity which followed the 1945 liberation of the camps.
One day they came, it was already January 45, cold, slippery, muggy, every good thing. They said they're going to liquidate the camp and we should go on the march. And they knew that the Allied forces are coming. We didn't know. I went over to the girls and I said, come on, if I can do it, you can too. Come on. She looked at me. She said, no, but you know what? I have something of great, great value and I want to give it to you. And I said, no, keep it, because after the war you will need it. She said, no, it's too late for me. And she produced the smallest little piece of soap you ever saw in your life. She said, in a free world, you have to be clean. Take it. We embraced and we cried for a long, long time. And I never saw her again. We had to march. So my sister is older. She gave me her shoes. And she took some old schmattes from rags and wrapped like everybody else. It was January 1945. It was so slippery and cold, no food, nothing, that if you slipped, you couldn't get up. There was no way in heaven you could get up.
The Russians were advancing again. And we had to get out of the camp. They didn't let us there to be liberated. So we had to go on the so-called death march. You had to keep up because if you fell down, they shot you.
We were already starving for 5 years. At the beginning, they shot you right on the spot. But after a while, why waste a bullet? Let them freeze to death. And we walked for days and days. When the Germans got tired, we stopped. And then we couldn't get up. That's why they called the death march. Lo and behold, we come to the port. We saw boats. Real boats. Schnell, raus, raus, fast. So we went. We pushed ourselves on the boats like sardines. My two cousins, all my friends, everybody. It was an air raid, end of January. And the Germans, with the machine gun, with the dogs, ran to the bunkers. I pinched my sister and I said, they are human. Take a look, they're afraid. They left us on the boat. One of my girlfriends said, I am not staying on the boat. I'm coming down. So 14 of us, we went down. I, my sister, two other sisters, and we lay down to sleep. We said for the rest of our life, we want to sleep. When we got up, the boats were gone. We were heartbroken. Our chance to the free world, to Sweden, Switzerland. But we didn't know that the boats had holes in the bottom. And an hour and a half, all of them were drowned. My two cousins and all my friends, all of them drowned.
Suddenly, it was like tohu vabohu. Everybody was running. Germans were running. Guards were running in all directions. There were some barracks, and they were deserted. And he told us to lie down in those barracks, and lie flat. Suddenly, there were two Russians, and believe it or not, one of them was on a white horse, like you see Moshiach. We crawled out on all four from the tents because we couldn't walk. And we were crying. And he said, you are free, why are you crying? We were crying because we really couldn't believe it, we were free.
We heard distant shooting.
quite a few of us panicked inside this barn. We thought they come and shoot us. They must have shot already others. And the noise came nearer and nearer. And as we then dared to go out, we saw all our guards, the SS women and Schulz, being shot. They had to stand in a circle, and the Russians just didn't ask any questions, and they shot them. Whether anybody was decent or not, they were shot. So that was the hour of our liberation.
We were always imagining that when we are liberated, we're going to be dancing and kissing them, and I don't think they wanted to be kissed by us, to be honest. We didn't think of it that way. We didn't think we were so dreadful, you know, but to them we looked absolutely awful, of course. But all we wanted to do is to lie down and be allowed to be ill.
And as I was lying on the floor, almost dead, covered in sores, I saw this terrible, it seems to be gigantic tank coming through the gates, and hearing a terrible bang and seeing the German guard falling on the floor dead. He was shot. This huge tank, it looked like it was reaching up to the heaven. It was so big, this tank, and an American soldier came off there and he just picked me up like a piece of flesh from there and said, "My child, what's wrong with you?" I said, "I don't know, but put me down." I saw for the first time, face to face, a man who was colored. And the gentleness of this person. You know, I said to myself, well, I don't often say a prayer. In Auschwitz I did say once, if they say there is a God, it's not true. And I just said a prayer in my own way, thank God. That they didn't do to him what they do to my race. And this is the God's truth. I came out of my force. I was free. And I sat down. And I said to myself, now what? No mother, no father, no sister, no brother. But I'm free. And I said, I got to survive.
We heard on the radio that the war was over, which was on the 8th of May, 1945. I went alone out onto a field. I lay down on the warm earth and began to cry. And it was the first time that I had a terrible sadness about the people I lost. And came a young girl, anything between 15 and 18. She saw that I still had my uniform on so that people would know who I am, that I'm not a Nazi or anyone like that. And she knelt down and embraced me and kissed me like a sister. She was very sweet. And these were the first normal human words that I have had. A number of people from the camps, they heard that in the forest nearby there were some SS men were hiding, and they went to hunt them with guns, and they invited me to go as well. I could not do that. And at the time I thought, is it a weakness? Is this a strength? Am I soft-headed? Because these murderers deserve anything. I couldn't do it. Later on I thought about it and I haven't regretted it. Even to this very day I feel that I couldn't adopt the same approach to them as they have to us.
We were freed by the Russian army. A lot of people who were freed by the Americans died from overeating. We were not that lucky. We didn't get much food. We were starving even after we were freed.
They did establish hospitals. And I went to hospital because I had typhus, and people around me were dying. And I could see the look on their faces. I knew when they were going to die. And I refused to look at myself in the mirror. I said, I'm not going to look in the mirror, because if I see that I'm that ill, I'll die just of the fear of it. There were German doctors and nurses still looking after us. I remember a German doctor coming, and he looked at me, and he told to these Germans, it was in the evening, she won't last till the morning, about me. And I said to myself, that's what you think. That really gave me strength. I was very frightened, I can tell you. But I refused to go to sleep because I thought I'm not going to wake up. So I used to stay up every night and sleep during the day, and I wouldn't go to sleep.
We came back to Poland. Nobody was alive. I went to school in Poland. Back to school, yeah. So I was the only Jewish girl there. They were saying like this, thank God Poland is without Jews. Thank God. We don't need them. And I was scared, so I dropped out. We lived on the second floor, and downstairs on the first floor was the young girls and boys on the way to Israel right after the war. I knew most of them. The 1946 was the pogrom in Kielce. And they killed them all, 42 girls and boys. They cut off their heads. I said, I am not staying one day here, not a half a day. I'm leaving. Those all were young survivors from the camps.
The war ended. The Americans marched in. The second day, I joined the American Army as an interpreter and as an investigator. I worked with the War Crimes Commission for 1.5 years, helping preparing the trial of Nuremberg. And we took trucks, and we went from camp to camp, and took every piece of paper, the records, because the Germans kept very good records. But not only about the prisoners, but about themselves too. In fact, when we went to the barracks, to the SS barracks, we removed from the beds the names of the SS. This is proof. In 46, started the trial of Nuremberg. I was called from United States 3 times to be a witness at the Sachsenhausen trial, the Auschwitz trial, and the Gross Rosen trial.
The communists, the first thing they did is took away 3 factories. Since I spoke good German and good Russian, I became the manager from one of the big salami factories. And this was my beautiful revenge over the Germans. They were horrified of me. They called me Kleine Chefi, little boss. I was only 24. They were more or less our prisoners, even though they were free to go home. But to work in our factory meant life. At night when they left, they steal a salami. But I knew how to look. I could tell by the face whoever was hiding something. And I would drag them out of the line. And I would say, search him. One man got on his knees and he kissed the toes of my shoes and he begged me to let him work, and I said no. And then one of my friends said, if you walk out of there, maybe he'll kill you. I said, I don't care. The pleasure of telling him, no, you cannot work here, I think that brought back my sanity. I could do anything I wanted. I could put them in prison, I could tell, but it was just the satisfaction. Take their vodka and tear it in as many pieces as I could. And that would make me happy. And when they would cry and they would say, this is the food I have to bring, I said, you at least remain alive. But when you people found something that we were bringing home, you killed us. After a month, I couldn't do it anymore. One day I came home and I was crying. My girlfriend said, what's the matter? And I said, the pleasure of being mean is over. I can't do it anymore. I don't want to do it anymore. I knew I was free. After this, I was... my husband, who also found out that I was in Berlin, sent for me. And I, with help, we escaped Berlin and went to Munich. And Munich was the American zone.
To the first Jewish service held in Belsen concentration camp after its liberation by British soldiers. Rather less than half the surviving population in the camp was Jewish. The service was held by the Jewish chaplain to the British Second Army. It was held in the open air amidst corpses and filth. There were perhaps 200 or 300 worshippers gathered together, all of them in tears. These people knew they were being recorded. They wanted the world to hear their voice. They made a tremendous effort that quite exhausted them.
This BBC recording was made in May 1945 by reporter Patrick Gordon Walker at the liberation of the Belsen concentration camp. And you heard part of Voices of the Shoah, produced by David Nodowitz for Rhino Records, with an accompanying book of photos, interviews, and historical perspectives. Proceeds from this box set go to the Jewish Federation of Greater Los Angeles. There's links to all this and all the stories in this hour at hearingvoices.com. For Hearing Voices, I'm Rabbi Samuel M. Kohan of Temple Emmanuel in Tucson and 2JewishRadio.com.
Am Yisrael Chai, the children of Israel still liveth.
Amen. Hearing Voices is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art. Our producers are Scott Carrier, Ann Hepperman, Larry Massett, and Kara Oler. Our intern is Max Darum. Mix engineer is Robin Wise of soundimagery.com. Executive producer is Barrett Golding. From NPR, National Public Radio, this is hearingvoices.com.